With me this week, as we continue our series on the founders and the Constitution, is Dr. Stephen Klugowitz, Executive Director of Collegiate Network, a nonprofit foundation that provides financial and technical assistance to student editors and writers of independent publications, and former Director of Education Programs for the Bill of Rights Institute. Klugowitz is the author of the Essay on Freedom of Religion for the Founders and the Constitution series. Welcome, Stephen.
Thanks, Brian. Glad to be here.
At the start of your essay, you write that the road to achieving full religious liberty in the United States was long and arduous, and you spend much of the rest of your time showing this to be true. So let's take the same approach and begin, as you do, with the myth of the Puritans, the myth being that they came to America in pursuit of religious freedom. Why is that a myth?
Well, the Puritans certainly came to America in pursuit of their religious freedom, but they had no desire to establish religious freedom for any other groups. Of course, Puritan comes from the word pure, and the Puritans were a group in England, originally within the Anglican Church, that thought the Anglican Church was corrupted, that it was covered with these vestiges of Catholicism, Roman Catholicism, and the Puritans practiced these dissenting beliefs, or tried to in England, and were persecuted and fled to America. So when they set up their commonwealth, they were also intolerant. They didn't want anyone who held different beliefs corrupting their pure commonwealth in Massachusetts Bay. A good example of the persecution that the Puritans engaged in was a 1647 law the colony passed that declared that all Roman Catholic priests were to be banished from the colony and any who returned executed. Now, there's no record of a Catholic priest actually being executed, but there were four Quakers who were put to death between 1659 and 1661.
Okay, so let's say the origins of religious freedom in America may have some problems. But nevertheless, you write that by 1787, we as a people are committed to the principle of religious toleration and to the idea of separation of church and state. That's a major change, and we should talk about how we got there. But first, define for us the word toleration, because we just switched from the term freedom to toleration. What's the difference?
Yes, there were several terms used in this era by Americans, and each had a different shade of meaning. Religious toleration is the term I use often and was often used at the time. Religious liberty, liberty of conscience, or the rights of conscience. I think the first term, religious toleration, suggests that a certain set of religious beliefs is to be preferred to others. To tolerate something means that you put up with something that you deem to be wrong. And, you know, this was the earliest view of quote-unquote religious freedom, that you would just tolerate something. One thing was right, one set of beliefs was right, maybe an established church, but you would tolerate, put up with these dissenting beliefs. Now, I think later on you get more talk, and certainly in America, of a broader sort of thing like religious liberty or liberty of conscience and the rights of conscience. But the terms can be used and were used interchangeably at the time.
But technically, we begin with toleration, and then we move toward freedom at some point.
Yes, I would say generally that's true.
Okay, so let's talk about the origins of either toleration or freedom of religion. Get us started with the European origins.
Well, the idea of a separation between church and state is really, at heart, a Christian idea. You can trace it back to Jesus himself, who declared that man should render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's. And this was developed by the great Christian thinkers. Augustine of Hippo talked about the city of God, the city of man. So you really had an idea of at least separation of church and state from the time of Christendom through the Middle Ages. But why we got to this era of toleration, it was really a practical matter. The Reformation takes place, of course, in the early 16th century, and the unity of Christendom is broken apart. And you have so many competing groups, one country containing Protestants, often of various varieties, and Catholics. And it really becomes a practical matter. Now, this is not to say that the early Protestant reformers were champions of religious freedom. Quite to the contrary. If you look at somebody like John Calvin, who set up a very totalitarian state in Geneva, or, of course, Henry VIII, who set up the king as the head of the church. I mean, that is not separation of church and state. But it was the effect of the Reformation, not the reformers themselves, but the effect of splintering Christianity into these various groups that made it a necessity for people just to get along.
So it's more of a practical reaction than it is a theoretical position?
Yes, I think largely so. I mean, you had some kind of abortive attempts in Europe, the Edict of Nantes in 1598, which was later repealed by Louis XIV. But it was really not until you get to America that you really get religious freedom established on a lasting basis.
Okay, let's talk about America. What are some of the colonial precedents?
Well, of course, Rhode Island, the establishment of Rhode Island. Roger Williams lived in Massachusetts, but he was forced to flee the Puritan Commonwealth because of his dissenting religious views, and he set up Rhode Island and instituted toleration for all people. The colony became a refuge quickly for groups like the Quakers and the Baptists. You had Maryland, which was set up by the Calvert family, and here was a great example, unlike Williams, who, well, he had to flee, of course, so I guess you could say it's practical necessity, but he also had a real philosophical commitment to religious liberty. Calverts in Maryland are Catholic and certainly want a place where they can go and not be persecuted, but they established toleration really to lure Protestants, knowing that most of the people who are going to come are going to be Protestant, and if you want people to come, most of England's Protestant, you're going to have some sort of toleration. The earliest ships that came to Maryland, the Ark and the Dove, which brought the Calverts, actually had a majority of Protestants on board. So that, again, was a necessity. You also had William Penn, who definitely here is a commitment of principle. Penn sets up Pennsylvania. He's a Quaker. Again, you know, self-interest. He's a Quaker. He wants a place where his people can worship. But like Roger Williams, he set up his colony to be a refuge for people of all religious sects.
So we have colonial precedents. But then you write that in the 1760s and 70s, which were the years leading up to American independence, we take another major step forward. We strengthen our commitment to religious liberty. How and why did that come about?
Well, again, back to this sort of practical necessity and just looking at history. I think by the late 18th century, Americans realized they had looked at the example of 17th century England, the wars, the conflict, and they saw that religious persecution was ultimately detrimental to the political, social, and economic welfare of a nation. And in America, where you had even more Christian groups than in England, if you adopted intolerance, this would be really adverse to the nation's prospects. And I think the colonial crisis of the 1760s and 1770s reinforced this view. I mean, it wasn't just the economic measures passed by Parliament that alarmed Americans, but the Patriot leaders also warned of the danger of the English church, the Anglican church, and their interference in American religious affairs. I mean, there was as much talk about the British government installing a bishop in America who would become the instrument of tyranny as there was about the Stamp Act or other offensive economic measures passed by the Parliament.
But as a result, nearly all of the state constitutions, the first state constitutions written after independence, reflected to some extent a commitment to religious liberty. Give us one example in the short time we have.
Well, you have several examples. Virginia, the Virginia Declaration of Rights, part of the Constitution of 1776, proclaimed that religion or the duty which we owe to our Creator and the manner of discharging it can be directed only by reason and conviction, not by force or violence. And this sort of language was reflected in other constitutions as well.
And that's a direct tie-in, of course, to 1787. When the founders meet in Philadelphia, there's plenty of precedent for providing some provisions for free exercise of religion and separation of church and state. And as you write, it's reflected in Article 6 of the Constitution and in the First Amendment, which actually is adopted after. But tell us briefly how each of those provisions provide for religious freedom.
Article 6 of the Constitution explicitly states that no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. So federal offices can't ask someone about his or her religious beliefs. The First Amendment, of course, which is going to be ratified in 1791, declared that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So those are the two key elements of the Constitution which enshrine separation of church and state and religious liberty.
Okay, but Article 6 refers to national government, and the First Amendment only restricts the Congress, not the states. So how much impact did these provisions actually have on advancing the cause of freedom of religion?
Well, I think they had an impact. I mean, at the time, you're right, the right of the states to set their own policy in regard to religion was acknowledged, and it was acknowledged implicitly in Article 1 of the Constitution, which stipulated that to be eligible to vote in elections for the United States House of Representatives, the elector, the voter, in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors or voters of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. In other words, if you were qualified to vote for the state legislature, the lower branch, you could vote on the federal election for the U.S. House of Representatives. Well, several states at the time mandated a religious test as a requirement for the franchise, and therefore, really implicitly, the Constitution approved such tests. But again, I think that the principle being established at the federal level set the tone for the country that later on the states were going to, of their own accord often, abolish religious tests, separate church and state fully. And then, of course, we're going to get into incorporation cases in which the Supreme Court mandates that the First Amendment apply to the states. And that comes later in the mid-20th century.
I want to deal with that because there's a popular misconception, go back to our idea of myth, if you wish, that we need to take on here. And that's many people. I find students, for example, in the classroom, once they've read the First Amendment and they see this as being adopted, they automatically assume at that point that there's separation of church and state at all levels and freedom of religion. But that's not the case because still at the state level or the First Amendment doesn't apply to the states to begin with. Is that correct?
Correct.
And how did it evolve then after that? How did we reach the point, because several states continued to have an establishment of religion, how did we eventually reach the point where we could say that we did have separation of church and state and freedom of religion, if indeed we could ever say that?
Well, again, I think the ball did get rolling at the time of the Revolution, and even though the Constitution left the states alone, I mean, there was an idea of federalism there. The real movement, the momentum, was with people on the side of separation and of church and state and religious liberty. And simply the states throughout the 19th century began to abandon religious tests and, you know, any sort of public tax for the support of Christian ministers, which was a common thing at the time of the founding. But again, it's not until the mid-20th century that you get the Supreme Court explicitly applying the First Amendment to the states. And the case, the most famous important case there, is Everson versus Board of Education in 1947. And in that case, Justice Hugo Black, without quoting the case in toto here, basically applied the First Amendment and expounded upon what it meant. And he applied these protections in terms of religious liberty and separation of church and state to the states. And he quoted in his decision Thomas Jefferson, who of course coined the phrase in 1802, wall of separation between church and state. Now, that's not in the Constitution, but many people think it is, and Hugo Black took a lot of heat for quoting something outside the Constitution. It's just Thomas Jefferson's letter when he assumes the presidency to the Danbury Baptist congregation. Justice Rehnquist, among others, has been a critic of Justice Black for this, but really it's around that time it's formalized by the courts that the First Amendment does apply to the states.
Okay, now we only have a couple minutes left, but if we go back to the phrase you used earlier that we probably want to clarify here or define, the Everson case is based on the idea of incorporation. Very briefly, how did that work?
Incorporation just means simply that the Supreme Court began to incorporate the states into the coverage, into the liberties that are protected in the Bill of Rights and then other amendments. That's simply what it means. It was a series of cases beginning in the late 19th century and extending into the 20th that did just this, the court saying this liberty, which in the Bill of Rights, whatever amendment it may be, which at the time applied just to the federal government, actually applies to the state. So it was really done by judicial fiat.
Okay, so really I don't want to oversimplify here, but what we're talking about essentially is a work in progress when we talk about freedom of religion in America.
Yes, yes. Now, one interesting note, and this is where we get to present day issues, and I tread on dangerous territory here, but we often speak of separation of church and state and freedom of religion as going hand in hand. That's what we've been doing as we've been talking, but in fact, there's a tension sometimes between the two concepts, and I think it's become greater in modern legal thought to the point where the question becomes, when does the separation of church and state begin to infringe on religious liberty? The Supreme Court has, as I've said, has been the prime mover in widening the separation between church and state, but you can say that they have done so sometimes at the expense of religious liberty in cases where, say, school prayer has been restricted or religious displays on public property curtailed. I mean, some may look at that and say, that's proper, that's great, this way we protect religious liberty and separation of church and state. Others may say, well, you're restricting someone's right to exercise their religious beliefs by prohibiting school prayer or putting up a Ten Commandments monument in the judicial building, as we saw in Alabama recently. Now, whether Americans have gone too far in separating church and state is a question I will leave to others.
It's the perfect transition to an entirely different show, which we don't have time to do today, but that's a great way to end it. So, thank you, Stephen.
Thanks, Brian.
You've been listening to Dr. Stephen Klugowitz, Executive Director of Collegiate Network and the author of the essay on freedom of religion for the Founders and the Constitution series. And this is Talking History.